Hello, everybody. Delighted to be with you today. We're not going to do too many introductions. We are here today. This is the sixth of our Shiurim. We've got one more week after this week. And we're going to talk about Rabbi Sacks's book, The Great Partnership. A minute, I'm just going to silence whoever needs to be silenced here. If people could just like make sure they're muted so that we don't have interference, that would be great. Today we're going to talk about the book, The Great Partnership. And I think I called this, How Does Rabbi Sacks Read the Creation Chapter? And we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that today. How did Rabbi Sacks look at Bereshit? Rabbi Sacks is somebody who talks about how he has absolutely no problem with the theory of evolution and wants to read Sefer Bereshit, or the creation chapter, according to the theory of evolution. And we're going to get to that towards the middle or even the end of our shiur today. But first, I want to introduce you to the great partnership in this book. And we're going to start off with a video by Rabbi Sacks. I looks like I... One second. I can't... Ollie, I'm not a host. I think I'm not a host. Because...
Sorry. I thought I made co-host, but I guess I did not. No, you're good to go now.
Okay, fantastic. So what I want to do is we're going to just listen to Rabbi Sacks introduce us the book. And then... we will be able to see what we're going to do with it and start learning it.
At various times in history, including now, people have thought that there was a conflict between religion and science. At the time of Galileo, when religion was the stronger of the two, religious belief was used to reject science. Today, when science is stronger, it's sometimes used to reject religion. In fact, though, this whole idea is mistaken. Religion and science are completely different things, and neither negates the other. They are as unlike as poetry and prose, or song and speech, or a portrait of a person and an MRI scan. The human mind is capable of doing two quite different things. One is the ability to break things down into their constituent parts and see how they mesh and interact. This is often called left-brain thinking, and the best example is science. The other, often called right-brain thinking, is the ability to join events together so that they tell a story, or to join people together so that they form relationships. The best example of this is religion. To put it at its simplest, science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. And we need them both, the way we need the two hemispheres of the brain. Science is about explanation. Religion is about interpretation. Science analyzes. Religion integrates. Science breaks things down to their component parts. Religion binds people together in relationships of trust. Science tells us what is. Religion tells us what ought to be. Science describes. Religion inspires, beckons, calls. Science practices detachment. Religion is the art of attachment, self to self, soul to soul. Science sees the underlying order of the physical world. Religion hears the music beneath the noise. Science is the conquest of ignorance. Religion is the redemption of solitude. One way of seeing the difference is to think about their relationship with time. Science looks for causes of events. And a cause always comes before its effect. How did the window break? Because I threw a stone at it. First came the throwing of the stone, then came the breaking of the window. Science looks back from effect to cause. However, human action is always looking forward. Why did I throw the stone? Because I wanted to wake someone who was asleep to warn them that the building next door is on fire. An action always seeks to bring about something in the future. And that's where religion comes in, as our deepest guide to the future, the promised land, the messianic age, the vision of the prophets we travel toward. When we work for a world in which people finally recognize the image of God in the people not like them, and so bring an end to violence and war. Or sometimes it's about eternal life and the destiny of the soul after death. Either way, religion isn't about causes, but about purposes. Why then do we need science? Because we need to understand the world if we're to honor God's purposes within it. We need to understand disease if we're to cure it. We need to understand the causes of poverty if we're to alleviate it. We need to understand our destructive drives if we're to rise above them. And why do we need religion? Because that's what gives human life its meaning and purpose. The universe is more than the result of an accidental fluctuation in the quantum field at the dawn of time. Human life is more than the unintended consequence of random genetic mutations blindly sifted by natural selection. Just as there's something within us that's beyond the purely physical, so there's something within the universe, we call it the divine presence, that's beyond the merely material. And just as God created the universe in love, justice, and compassion, so he calls on us to create relationships of love, justice, and compassion. Or to put it another way, the difference between religion and science is the difference between the impersonal and the personal. When you treat impersonal phenomena as if they were persons, the result is myth. Light is the sun god, rain is the sky god, natural disasters are battles between the gods, and so on. Science was born when people stopped telling stories about nature and instead observed it. In other words, when they relinquished myth. And when you treat persons impersonally, as if they were objects, the result is dehumanization. People categorized by color, class, or creed, and treated differently as a result. The religion of the Bible was born when people stopped seeing people as useful or useless objects and began to see each individual as unique, sacrosanct, the image of God. So we need both religion and science. Albert Einstein said it most famously, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." We need science to understand the universe and religion to guide our way within it. From the world as it is to the world as it ought to be. A world of peace, justice, compassion and love. When we, God's creations, honor God, our Creator.
Okay, so you just got the theory of the book in one very short video. And now you understand that this is a book about science and religion and about how, in fact, according to Rabbi Sacks, science and religion do not need to be enemies. Science and religion can go hand in hand. And that is really what he's talking about in the book. But we just got a very, very nice, how should I say it? A nice, calm understanding of the book. I think there is something much deeper or much more. I mean, Rabbi Sacks didn't need to spend however long he spent writing this book. How big is it? Hold on. A 300-page book with hundreds of footnotes in order to tell us that point. There is clearly something irking Rabbi Sacks, which makes him decide to write an entire book about this. And that's really what I want to address with you today. And if you take a look at the sheets, which I think are going to be shared in the chat in case you don't have them, I want you to read with me the what I think is really irking Rabbi Sacks. By the way, you have that video, you have the URL of it. That's at the top of the sheet. And now let's take a look. What riveted the neo-Darwinians was the implication that evolution proceeded by mere chance, random genetic mutation, which produced the variety on which natural selection could work. In other words, if we accept, as science does, that the world that we live in and ourselves have come into being by random genetic mutation, then what's the implication? Stephen Jay Gould drew the conclusion that if the tape of evolution were to be replayed, there would be no certainty that Homo sapiens would emerge. So, not only were human beings not made by an act of special divine creation, their very existence was pure accident. So, we are nothing. Our planet is insignificant. Our existence a mere causera in time. Our noblest thoughts conceal base intentions. There is no freedom, just necessity. There is no truth, just hegemonic narrative. There is no moral beauty, just a sordid struggle to survive. In short, that paragraph is what was bothering Rabbi Sacks. If you want to follow Rabbi Sacks through this book, Rabbi Sacks, in fact, decides to go and take on the great evolutionary biologist people like, and he sought out Richard Dawkins, right? The man who had written The Selfish Gene and who had written all of these books, The God Delusion. And I think I've mentioned in a previous class that Rabbi Sacks, before he became a rabbi, before he even went into philosophy, he thought always that he would become a barrister. A barrister, a court lawyer. He loved being part of the debating society as a teenager. Rabbi Sacks is up for a fight. And here, who's he fighting? He's fighting Richard Dawkins. He's fighting the evolutionary biologist. And what's irking him? What's bothering him? What's burning in his kishkas here? It is the fact, and here, if we go back to look at what the name of this book is, it's The Great Partnership, God, Science, and the Search for Meaning. What Rabbi Sacks is worried about, what concerns him, what is upsetting him, is how can we possibly consider a world without meaning? Because if we go back to our sheet, if we say that we are a pure accident, right, then we're just a causera in time. We're just an accident of a sort of genetic mutation. We're not free. We're a cause of just forces which have created our being here with survival of the fittest. There's no truth. The stories we tell are just there to sort of like make us feel good about ourselves. There's no moral beauty. There's a sordid struggle to survive. Then really, what is going to happen to humankind? And in a minute, we're going to talk about where Rabbi Sacks is concerned that humankind is going to be. We're going to come back to the central theory of the book, let me just add, because there's one paragraph I couldn't resist putting in here. He says, there's something surpassingly odd about this. During the entire period that this drama of disillusionment was being enacted, he's talking about in the Age of Reason, human powers of understanding, explanation, control were expanding beyond all previous imaginations and at ever faster rate. How is it that the human achievements become, the higher human achievements become, the lower the human self-image sinks? And this is what he's really worrying about, that the human self-image is sinking, that we're thinking lower and lower about ourselves. And therefore, at the core of this is going to be an argument between two different ways of looking at the universe. One way says that we're here by genetic mutation and there's no real meaning in our lives. There's no reason why we're here. And in the meantime, we might as well just have fun. We might as well do whatever we feel like. No one should be able to tell us what to do. And if you go online and you look at a BBC debate between Rabbi Sacks and Richard Dawkins, where Richard Dawkins, by the way, puts forward a very good case as a scientist. But what he's basically proposing, he keeps on hammering away at Rabbi Sacks and saying, yes, but you can't tell me that there's any meaning here. You can't prove. Where do you develop the idea of meaning? And he also says, how should it be that you should be able to ever tell your children what to do? Why should you, what is meaningful for you might not be meaningful to your children. I think he says it's immoral that if you are Jewish, you should raise your child as a Jew. Let your child decide what he wants to be. Let's just go through some of what Rabbi Sacks does in the early chapters, and then we're going to get into some of the major important pieces. First of all, let's reinforce this particular line, which Rabbi Sacks repeats several times in the book. Science take things apart to see how they work. Religion put things together to see what they mean. And he talks about the idea that religion and science and religion are two very different things. He very much talks about two major influences on the Western world, where science is all about explanation, causality, definition. It is, if you want, it is the comes from the heritage of Greece. And he puts against the Greek way of looking at things, the heritage of Greece, pits it against the heritage of Israel. By the way, in a few minutes, I'll talk a little bit about Christianity. We'll see if we get there. But let's see what we can read a little bit. First of all, at the core is a question about meaning. And this is what he wants to say. I'm reading the section which says page 32. We cannot prove that life is meaningful and that God exists. But neither can we prove that love is better than hate, altruism than selfishness, forgiveness than the desire for revenge. We cannot prove that hope is truer to experience than a tragic sense of life. Almost none of the truths by which we live are provable, and the desire to prove them is based on monumental confusion between explanation and interpretation. Explanations can be proved, interpretations cannot. Science deals in explanation. Meaning is always a matter of interpretation. So Rabbi Sacks wants to say that science is great. It explains how we got here. It will explain a lot about the fabric of existence. It will help us be able to cure disease and develop new cures for the future. We love science. In fact, he talks about the idea that Judaism says a bracha when you see a scientist, a wise person. He says, I have no, but what you want to do, he says, you evolutionary scientists, not only do you want me to tell me how we got here, but you always also want to tell me what that means. And you're basically telling me there is no meaning. And you're not just telling me about, therefore, how I should live my future, that it's absurd to be religious. And he says that that's not fair, because science is good as explanation, but meaning is a matter of interpretation. And therefore, science masquerading as religion is as unseemly as religion masquerading as science. He says religious people shouldn't tell us how the world came into being. Religious people shouldn't say, go to a Rebbe, don't go to a doctor. And science shouldn't try and do religion. What's religion? It's about meaning. I will have respect as a religious person for science, and science should have respect for me. One of the things that he talks about is that scientists will make fun of him and say, how can it be that you have, you're just, and by the way, he's going to put up several figures, Spinoza, Marx, Freud, and others, and really, get into them and explain why he has a real issue with them. But let me just share here what he says. I never understood why it'd be considered more courageous to despair than to hope. Freud said that religious faith was the comforting illusion that there is no father figure. In other words, we've got issues with our father, and therefore we're looking for a father figure. A religious believer might say that atheism is the comforting illusion that there's no father figure, that we can do what we like and get away with it, an adolescent's dream. Why should one be considered escapist and not the other? Why should God's call to responsibility be considered an easy option? Why should the belief held by some on the basis of scientific determinism that we have no free will, and therefore no moral responsibility, not be considered the greatest escapism of them all? And therefore, Rabbi Sacks, and I'm going to give you the contents of the book in a minute and explain how the book argues, but basically, let me just go through two more sound bites of Rabbi Sacks and then see where we're going to explain the basic theory of the book. Number one, finding God. How do you find God? Again, what does he say? Faith is about seeing the miraculous in the everyday, not about waiting every day for the miraculous. Beautiful line. In other words, one of the claims of scientists is that religious people claim that, one of the things that Richard Dawkins hammers away at Rabbi Sacks, but don't you believe that the Jews crossed the Red Sea? That's absurd. Don't you believe in all these miracles? And Rabbi Sacks responds to him and says, but that's not the core. That's true. I do believe in those things, he says. But that's not the point. The point is about me seeing the miraculous in the everyday, not in waiting every day for miracles. Or, as he says here, they're going to say, well, if there's meaning in the world, where is it? Why isn't it so evident? And he says, meaning is made, it's not discovered. That's what religion for the most part is, the constant making and remaking of meaning. So what's really behind this book is not this very, very calm video that we just watched, where Rabbi Sacks talks about the fact that science is about detachment and religion is about attachment. Science is about order, and religion is about the music in the natural order. That's all true. But actually what is behind here is a polemic about why we're here, about the meaning of life, about whether religion is absurd, about whether the world of science is trying to take over, is to try to take over the world that we live in. And in fact, trying to claim that it is the inheritor and it is the guide to meaning. And therefore, let's take a look very quickly at the table of contents of this book, and then we'll try and get into a few details, and then we'll see where we go. So the first is going to be about God and the search for meaning. He talks about the meaning-seeking animal, that human beings have always been always been looking for meaning in two minds, right? In two minds is indeed this idea that there are lots of ways to see the world through different eyes. In other words, in two minds, he talks about that there is a Greek way of looking at the world and a Jewish way of looking at the world. There is a male way of looking at the world and a female way of looking at the world. There is an Eastern way of looking at the world and a Western way of looking at the world. He has lovely, and he says, why do you think there's only one way to look at this world? Really, really fabulous. In Diverging Paths, again, he goes back to Judaism versus Greece. And it's fact in here that he actually talks about the Christianity. I said I would mention Christianity. And I was actually quite surprised at this in this book, where he says that, because one of the things that he's arguing with a lot of scientists, a lot of evolutionary biologists, and he says, one of your problems is that you've grown up in Christianity. And he said, Christianity drew from Judaism, but it also drew from Greece. And he says, in fact, Christianity took too much from Greece. Really interesting. And therefore, he actually has a critique of Christianity. I'll just give you a few examples. Number one, the idea that that Judaism has particular and universal, but Christianity took the idea, like science, that everything is universal. In other words, Christianity has this concept that we have a universal way of looking at the world, and that everything should be universal, and therefore there's only one truth, and therefore you have to proselytize anyone. He says Judaism never believed in that. Number two, he talks about the notion of dualism. Dualism is an idea that essentially a pagan idea of there being good and evil, and the good is pitted against evil. So now he says you have heaven and hell, you have God versus the devil, you have all sorts of opposites. In fact, the opposite of, if you want, sin, the flesh is sin, versus spirit. He said Judaism never had such a stark dichotomy of heaven and hell, this world and the afterlife, the flesh and the spirit. And he said in this regard, Christianity took the dualism of Greece. Third, he spoke about the fall, the idea that human beings are in some way evil, right? And he said they're fallen and they need the sense of redemption. It's very stark in Christianity. And he says it comes from a mythological idea. The difference between faith and action, okay, whereas you probably know Christianity said that what really matters is what's in your heart, where he says Judaism always believed very strong affinity between action and ideas, okay? And the last one I'll mention, which is really powerful, where he says when Moshe Rabbeinu is at the snare, when Moses is at the burning bush, he asks God, what is your name? And what does God say? Eheyeh asher eheyeh. Now, what does that mean? And Rabbi Sacks says that the Christian interpretation, which is based on Greek ideas, is I am what I am. In other words, a sense of belief of God as a static God, that God is beyond everything. God is everything. God is beyond time. God is beyond place. He says, but actually, Eheyeh, Asher Eheyeh means I will be what I will be. It's God in the future tense. And in fact, he says what it's really saying is that God is defining himself as the Lord of history. And as the Lord of history, God is not what the Greeks saw as the God, which is a God that you have faith in, right? That you have to believe in, that you have to prove. He said in Judaism, God is part of the narrative. We don't prove God. We interact with God. And in that regard, God is changing all the time. He is with us in Egypt, and he is with us in Galut, and he is the God who heals, and he is the God who is present. And therefore, here we see a very stark difference between the way Christians look at the world, which he says is part of the problem of these evolutionary biologists, that they've grown up with a Christian conception of God rather than a Jewish one. Really, really fascinating definition. Maybe I'll just say one last thing about Greece and Judaism in this regard, which I found absolutely fantastic. You probably know the theory of the story, the myth of Prometheus, who stole fire from God, right? You all know that. He stole fire from Zeus. And he says that this is one of the foundational stories in the Greek mythology, that we try to steal from God, steal from Zeus fire. And of course, he was punished for the rest of his life. Living hell he had, where his liver was eaten every single day. He said, well, here's the interesting thing about Judaism. We do a ceremony every single week. It's the first thing we do in the week. And it's called Havdalah. We light fire. And why? And what's the story behind Havdalah? The story is that man sinned and man was going to be exiled from the Garden of Eden. And man was very, very afraid. And God saw that man was afraid. So what did God do? He showed man how to have fire, how to create fire. And we commemorate God giving man the power of fire every single week. What does he say here? In the Greek world, right, the gods don't want man to have knowledge, right? The gods are against. Whereas in the Jewish version, God says, here, I believe you should have all the knowledge in the world, right? I want to help you, right? Completely different conception of God than in the Greek system. Let's go back to our sheets and just follow the theory of the book. And then, share screen. Here we go. So he basically talks about the idea that he sets up this dichotomy and says essentially that Judaism, all this first section is all about the fact that Greece has its place, Judaism has a different thing. Basically, he almost very beautifully says that Judaism doesn't try and prove God in the laboratory. That's what we call the God of Aristotle. But we have the God of Abraham, and the God of Abraham is the God who encounters us and we encounter him. And that is what mitzvah is all about. And that is why the Torah actually isn't a philosophical treatise, but in fact, it tells stories. And stories is where we make mistakes and God guides us, and it's meeting God in the real world. Number two, why does it matter? Let's just go very quickly. What do we stand to lose? We stand to lose a lot. Human dignity, freedom, morality, relationships, and a meaningful life. In other words, what Rabbi Sacks wants to say is if we don't have religion, our society is in peril. Okay? And in the third section, what does he deal with? Section number three, faith and its challenges. How does religion deal with Darwinism? Okay? How does it deal with the problem of evil? What happens when religion goes wrong, religion and violence? And then he has why God? Okay? It's, by the way, a beautiful, beautiful chapter where he goes through why we should believe in God and gives like five or six different reasons about why we might want to believe in God. And that will explain the appendix, by the way, is fascinating. He has a whole 20 pages or 30 pages of sources to explain how you can resolve Sefer Bereshit, or the story of creation in Bereshit, with evolution. Okay, so let's quickly see where we're going to go with this. I'll do very quickly what you see on page two, the dangers, and then I want to go into three themes which we're going to discuss today, and hopefully that will enable us to use our time successfully. Some of the dangers. Let's just take a look and read this together. I'm at the bottom on your source sheet of page two. Two figures in particular had views very close to today's secular materialists, namely the 3rd century BCE Greek thinker Epicurus and his Roman disciple 2.5 centuries later, Lucretius. They believe that the material world is all there is. We have no souls. There is no life after death. The gods are uninterested in the affairs of human beings. We're here, we live, we die and cease to be. There's nothing to fear about death because we're here. When we're here, death is not. And when death is here, we're not. By the way, the word apikores maybe comes from Epicurus. And if we call an apikores, usually in Judaism, a heretic, why would we be saying that? Well, let's look at what Rabbi Sacks says. He says, Epicurus and Lucretius could be writing today. Their books would be bestsellers. How do they believe we should live? Unsurprisingly, they had no interest in the concepts of right and wrong. Human life is governed by two considerations only, the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. To pursue pleasure, it helps to have good food and good friends. To avoid pain, stay out of public life, which will only cause others to envy you. Do not marry or have children. The risk of emotional entanglement is too great. Sex is fine. Love is best avoided. Keep your wants simple. That way you won't be troubled by things you cannot afford. The end result will be ataraxia, tranquility of mind, that absence of passion that the Greeks, Stoics, cynics, and skeptics, as well as seem to see as the mark of a philosophical life. In other words, chill. Now, here, Rabbi Sacks is basically giving us an image of a sort of like, from his perspective, a dystopian future. A situation whereby, and by the way, in the next page, he goes in and says that, in fact, the ancient Greeks were also very into euthanasia, mercy killing. They had no problem with abortion. And he said that if there's no sanctity to human life, and if it's all about having a meaningful life, then why shouldn't we kill people when they get infirm? Why shouldn't we, sanctity of human life is in peril. And who knows where we will get after that? Let me even say more than that. If we're talking about dangers throughout the book, I don't remember any book of Rabbi Sacks where the Holocaust is mentioned so frequently. Rabbi Sacks is haunted by a secular regime where we have, as he mentioned so many times through the book, Nietzsche and the will to power, the idea that you can have a regime where we have no morals, where we don't understand why we are here, where all that's left is either pleasure or a lack of morality. And then what's going to rule? What's going to rule? The theory of evolution, which is what? Survival of the fittest. And if survival of the fittest, then the weak can be disposed of, euthanasia, or the final solution. If I decide that Jews are a cancer in the vermin of creation, we will get rid of the Jews. And therefore, he, throughout this book, talks on the one hand about the threat of totalitarianism, the threat of Nazism, the threat of a breakdown of morality on the one hand. And number two, when he talks about meaning, he talks over and over and over about Holocaust survivors and what makes them have hope. And why should anyone want to continue living even when everything is bleak? And that is a sense of hope, a sense of meaning, the sense of dignity of human beings, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what Rabbi Sacks is setting up when he talks about dangers. This is a very, very, for Rabbi Sacks, what we're playing for here is the very heart of human society. So this is quite something. So let's move on. And I want to deal with three themes. Number one, the theme of freedom. Number two, the theme of creation. And number three, the problem of evil. Small themes, right? Freedom, creation, evil. So the first thing he talks about here is the notion of human freedom. And I'm reading here on page 3, where it says human freedom, page 124. And let's just read a little bit. Science cannot in and of itself give an account of human dignity, because dignity is based on human freedom. Freedom is a concept that lies outside the scope of science. That's interesting. Why? Science cannot locate freedom because its world is one of causal relationship. A stone is not free to fall or not to fall. Lightning does not choose when and where to strike. A scientific law is one that links one physical phenomenon to another without intervention of will and choice. In other words, science isn't a world of will and choice. To the extent that there is a science of human behavior, to that extent that there is implicit denial of the freedom of human behavior. That is precisely what Spinoza, Marx, and Freud were arguing, that freedom is an illusion, right? Marx said that we do things because of economic factors. Id, because of our id or our ego or because of our parents or whatever it might be. But if freedom is an illusion, then so is the human dignity based on that freedom. Science cannot but deconsecrate the human person. What a phrase. Thereby opening the gates to possible desecration. We are free. We know that as surely as we know anything. We know what it is to choose between alternatives, weigh the options, calculate the consequences, consult our conscience, ask the advice of others, and so on. He says, just think about your life. You know you're free. Yet throughout human history, human beings have found endless ways of denying choice. They say, it wasn't me, it was the will of the gods or the influence of the stars or malicious spirits or fortune, luck or happenstance. It was the way we were brought up or the influence of friends or economic circumstances or genetic endowment. In other words, human beings excel in shifting the blame, in deciding that it wasn't me. And now he says, let's go back to Tanakh. Denial of freedom goes back all the way to the first couple in the Garden of Eden, confronted with their sin. Adam blamed Eve and Eve blamed the serpents. Our excuses become more sophisticated over time, but they remain just that. The problem of free will has existed for close to 25 centuries. Plato discussed it, so does Aristotle. Paul spoke about it with great feeling in the Epistle to the Romans. One of the earliest statements occurs in the fourth chapter of Genesis. God senses that Cain is angry and is about to commit a great crime, and he warns him, telling him that he is in the grip of strong emotion and he can control it. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. In other words, the issue that he basically says is that science is a world of causality, and causality will then take away the notion and the consciousness that we are free. I don't know if you've ever, I remember once having a student come to me and tell me that he said that belief is really, really dumb. And he had read these books by the evolutionary biologist, and he told me that belief is really, really stupid because all it is certain enzymes in your body and certain causes and certain fears, and, you know, any rational person would never believe. And I said to him, what about love? And he said to me, yes, it's true. Love is also its enzymes, its endorphins, it's all that sort of stuff. So I said to him, I really, really hope that one day you really fall in love. You really fall in love with somebody you're crazy with, right? You fall in love head over heels, right? And I hope you get married to that person and you really form a life bond with that person. And I hope all your endorphins are kicking in and all your enzymes and everything else. And I hope it's as real as it can be. It will be as real as faith can be. In other words, just because there are causes doesn't mean it's not real. That's the way we're wired. Rabbi Sacks says that if you believe that we are all products of, psychological factors or be it evolutionary factors, then you won't see yourselves as free. But there's nothing more human than being free. And human, you know, what do we rail against? People incarcerating other people. So freedom is at the core of human dignity. And that's one of Rabbi Sacks's really important themes here in the book. And I would even say more than that. of Rabbi Sacks's thought in general. Let's talk a little bit about then how Rabbi Sacks deals with Sefer Bereshit, or particularly the creation chapter or chapters. And I think this is quite an important one because I hear people frequently in Orthodox circles really not dealing with this particularly well. And here I would say that Rabbi Sacks is not alone. Many modern Mefarshim share Rabbi Sacks's approach, and Rabbi Sacks wasn't the first. In fact, when I go to this approach, which is an approach I share with Rabbi Sacks, before I even read in Rabbi Sacks, I had read it in Rav Kook. And I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about how we deal with creation, because the claim, of course, is, and this has become even a political issue in the United States, where we have creationists who don't want people to teach evolution in school because it goes against the Bible. And is this really true? Even before Rav Kook, you know, many seven centuries before Rav Kook, eight centuries, was the Rambam. And the Rambam was very interesting. The Rambam said that he doesn't believe that Torah can go against science. I'll give you an example. He said, we've proven by science, that by logic, that God cannot have a body. And therefore it's absurd for God to have a body. He says, but the Torah says that God has a body. Torah talks about God's feet and God's hands and God's heart, God's back, God's front. He said, and therefore what do we do with that? We reinterpret the phrases. He said, if I was convinced that the world, there had never been a creation, if I was convinced that there had never been a creation, I would reinterpret Bereshit. That's quite a statement. In other words, science and religion go hand in hand. Now, we know there was a creation. Stephen Hawking, right, is the one who proved that the world is expanding from a single point. But he says that the world is something like 14 to 15 billion years old. So how do we deal with that? So I want to try and explain how we deal with that. Rabbi Sacks is going to take the following approach. The Tanakh doesn't come in a vacuum. The Tanakh comes in a world where everybody's stories are mythological. And in the same way as, for example, the Tanakh doesn't talk about cars and trucks or trains and airplanes, the Torah instead talks about shor v'chamor. It talks about an ox and a donkey. Likewise, the Torah can only be talking within the context of its time. Now, how do most people think that the world had come into being? They all had a mythological idea of the world. The gods, forces of nature were really gods. And the gods used to fight one another. And if we go back to the myths of, let's say, Babylon, the story of Gilgamesh, we know that the gods were all fighting and one killed the other, and out of the carcass of one of them, they made the world. And that they really weren't very happy. Human beings were created by accident. They weren't very happy about human beings at all. And in fact, they decided that they would create some humans who were in the image of God. You know who those were? Those were the kings. The kings were created in the image of God and they were part of the cosmic order, but all human beings were basically slaves. I'd even say more than that. In the world of mythology, the gods are, how should I call it, in the image of man. They fight, they compete, they kill each other, they have sex, they have children, they backstab each other. You can't trust them. They're very, very irrational, and they're very whimsical. Okay, so now, what's our Torah about? The creation chapter is not there in order to tell us how the world came into being. For that, we have Stephen Hawking's, we have the world of, you know, scientific discovery. Once again, Sefer Bereshit, the creation story, Bereshit Perek Aleph and Bereshit Perek Bet, is there not to tell us how the world got here, but why we are here. Okay? And what do we have? So let's talk a little bit about Bereshit. First of all, Bereshit, and by the way, you will find some of what I'm going to be sharing with you on the sheet on page 4 Sorry, one second. On page 4, where it says Genesis chapter 1, I'm just not reading because I don't really have the time, and I hope that I can do it a more successful job by being out of the text. What is Bereshit really coming to tell us? First of all, God is not part of nature, and nature is not God. In the world of mythology, the gods are part of this world. God stands above the world. He can judge the world, but he is not part of this world. Second of all, this is an ordered world. First of all, God orders the world slowly, slowly, until he can make a world for human beings. I'd even say more than that, this world is ordered. Maybe some of you know, right? He spends the first 3 days sorting out the world, really sorting out the mess, and almost creating a stage for human beings to come on the into the world. It's so organized that even the narrative is organized. Every day begins with Vayomer Elokim and ends with Vayhi Erev Vayivoker. The first day corresponds to the fourth, the Or and the Morot. The second day, he creates the heaven, the waters and the heavens. And on the fifth day, the birds, which are in the heavens, and the fish, which are in the waters. And on the third day, he creates dry land, which is corresponded to by the sixth day, when he creates animals and human beings. As we go through every day, what does God say? And it was good. Vayera Elokim ki tov. Lastly, human beings, every human being is in the image of God. Not just kings, every human being. And what does that mean? That every human being is a creator. Every human being has freedom, just like God has freedom. Every human being has dignity. Every human being, and if I would look at Bereshit, I would say it this way. You don't need to be afraid of the gods. You're not here by accident. God wanted you here. God made an entire world for you. Control the world and conquer it. Take responsibility. In chapter 2, we are there, lo'ovda u'lo'shamra, to serve and preserve the world. In other words, suddenly the Torah is giving the Jews a different narrative, not just how the world came into being, but rather the story of how we came into being is really a story about why we're here and what we're here for. What is the place of human beings vis-a-vis God? God can be relied upon. God is a fair God. God is a free God. We are free. We expect fairness from God. And human beings have dignity and responsibility. And this is a tremendous, puts human beings in a totally different place vis-a-vis religion. And therefore, when you look at it this way, there is no contradiction. Science comes to tell us how the world came into being, but Bereshit is coming to tell us why we're here and to try and shatter the whole mythological existence of what we, of the way people, when the Torah was being given, when Avraham Avinu stepped into the stage out of Mesopotamia, when the Jews stepped into the stage of history out of Egypt, to try and shatter that whole mythological way of looking at the world and to give different narrative. And in fact, of course, it is this sort of narrative which fired the whole, what we call Judeo-Christian tradition, which is at the foundation of Western civilization. So what a radical rereading, radical re-understanding of the entire existence of human beings. That's how Rabbi Sacks reads the creation chapter. I still want to deal with two final things on the sheet. So we're going to go back to the sheet and I'll share the screen again. I want to just go back to the question of faith. And here I'm going to stay on page, what is this now? Page four. Sorry, 1 minute. Yes, here we go. Page 4 at the top. You may say, I refuse to believe what I cannot test, what I cannot subject even in principle to some kind of proof. But the big decisions of life are like that. You never know in advance the facts that you would make your decision the right one under the circumstances. That applies to the decision to marry, to have children, to start a business, to undertake a research project, to write a symphony, to paint a picture. There is no creation without risk. So that's quite interesting. Science can't explain why we do things or why we should do things, the things which give life meaning. But now listen to this. What impresses me about the Bible is that it suggests that even for God, creating humanity was a risk, and one that at least once he regretted having taken. Those are the lines which he says at the end of Bereshit, where he says he regretted making man. The same is true about the basic attitudes we take towards life. To be human is to live in a world fraught with risk. We face a future that is unknowable, not just unknown. Faith is a risk, and there is no way of minimizing that risk of playing it safe. Hamlet's soliloquy, for in the sleep of death, what dreams may come, tell us that there is no death, let alone life without risk. Those who are unprepared to take a risk are unprepared to live fully. And look at this. Faith is what moves people to great achievement that defies probability and predictability. Science is all about probability and predictability. Faith is not certainty. It is the courage to live with uncertainty. Faith is never easy. The great heroes of the moral life, like the great artists and scientist thinkers, like anyone who's undertaken a life of high ideals, know failure after failure, disappointment after disappointment. What made them great is that they refused to despair. The sheer wonder that God could take the risk of creating a creature with the freedom to disobey him and wreck his world. There is no faith humans can have in God equal to the faith God must have in humankind to place us here as guardians of the vastness and splendor of the universe. In other words, if we are meant to be B'Tselem Elohim, if we are meant to be in the image of God, God had faith in us, maybe we can have faith in God. We exist because of God's faith in us. That's why I see in the faces of those I meet a trace of God's love that lifts me to try and love a little as God loves. In other words, God loved human beings enough to put us here. Maybe we should trust other human beings. Wow. I think that's very powerful. Let's go to one last thing, and then I'll be happy to take questions. And I want to go to one of the issues. You know what? I'll say two of the last issues in the book. One of them is, of course, going to be Darwinism. And I will say that in looking at Darwinism, Rabbi Sacks talks about the idea that there's nothing wrong with Darwinism. And in fact, Darwinism is indeed how we got here. By the way, let me just say that I mentioned Rav Kook before. Rav Kook, when he talks about Bereshit, he says, notice when the human story really begins. He says, you're going to tell me that the scientists say that we came from apes. We came from, you know, Neanderthals. We're not human. He says, but Rav Kook says, yes, but look where Bereshit begins. Bereshit begins with we're not herds of animals. It begins when a man leaves their parents to go and create the nuclear family. That's number one. And number two, what do we start off in chapter two? When man can take instruction and is expected to have moral responsibility. In other words, where does the story of humans begin? When we're capable of moral responsibility and when we begin the family. That's the beginning of human living. However we got here, whether we got here through evolution, however we got here, says Rav Kook, we're not interested in the Torah is not interested in the backstory, because the Torah is interested in morality, that story, not the story of how we got here. Rabbi Sacks, by the way, talks about all sorts of things which he's happy to about Darwinism, about evolution. And in fact, he says, isn't it amazing that God created a world that could create itself? He says, that's how God wants to create. God doesn't have to be involved in it. God gives the world responsibility that the world will evolve, that the world will create itself, right? And that's one of the things that he says is just remarkable. Okay, let's talk about the problem of evil, if we can, in 5 minutes, of course. What would be so difficult to explain the problem of evil in 5 minutes? But we'll try and do some of it with the time we have at our disposal. The Bible does not hide evil. It is an honest book, he says. In the face of unbearable or inexplicable, unjustifiable suffering, there are three responses. The first says, this life is not all there is. There's another world after death. There is heaven, there is peace and eternal life. So first of all, the first one will say, this world is hard, but you'll go to Olam Haba. It's interesting, by the way, the Tanakh says very, very little about Olam Haba. The second response, he says, is to see, I've highlighted these. I'm on, for those of you who've lost me, I'm on the top of page 6. The second response is to see, John Keats, that this world is a veil of soul making. We suffer so that we can grow. Others suffer so we can practice charity or kindness. The bad in our lives is an invitation to the good, for this is how we become morally responsible agents. In other words, people get sick so I can visit the sick. Rabbi Sacks says, as a response to suffering, the argument makes sense, but as justification for it, it makes no sense at all. The third response, he says, is to say, there is evil, therefore there is no God. There is no justice, there is no judge. The world as it is, homo hominus lupus est, man is wolf to man. This world is a restless searching for power after power that ceases only in death, as Hobbes said, a struggle for survival in a world of scarce resources, as Darwin argued, and there is no reason to expect otherwise. Life is absurd, human beings are cruel. Epicurus was right, pursue pleasure, avoid pain. Rabbi Sacks says, I personally cannot accept such a world, though many can and do. A world in which there is no God is one in which there are no limits to hubris, no principal constraints to the will to power. In a godless world, some no doubt will choose the way of Epicurus and live quietly amongst friends, but not all, and there's the rub. If there is no judge, there is no reason to expect justice. If there is no God, there is no transcendental thou shalt not. These were not theoretical propositions. In Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, and communist China, they were put into practice and tens of millions died. Now, by the way, the Rabbi Sacks doesn't say that religion can't be responsible for violence. He knows that. But basically, where's Rabbi Sacks going to end here? He says, so what should I do with evil? Well, the first thing he says is, right, we have to cry. He talks about crying. We have to cry out. We have to call evil. He says, by the way, here at the top of page 7, theodicy, the attempt to vindicate God's justice in the world of evil, is compelling evidence that in the translation of Abrahamic spirituality into the language of Plato and Aristotle, something is lost. What is lost is the cry. He says, Plato and Aristotle tried to explain God. They didn't cry. All the prophets cry. Number 2, he says, I'll say it very quickly. Abraham was taught by God. God taught him the idea of tzedakah or mishpat. And Abraham turns that on God and says, how can you not do justice, God, with Sodom? I'll just read the lines here. Will the judge of all earth not perform justice? Does Abraham seriously suspect God of injustice? Does he believe that there are in fact 50 innocent people in the city? And God has overlooked this fact? Does he believe that he's more righteous than God? But God is inviting Abraham to respond, for I've chosen him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Abraham challenges God because God invites him to challenge God. Do not accept injustice, even if you hear it in my name. That's what God is telling Abraham. And therefore, what does Rabbi Sacks say? The religion of Abraham is a religion of protest against evil in the name of God. The religion, there's double, this is, needs to be crossed out, but the religion of Abraham is a religion of protest against evil, even in the name of God. We are invited, or I'll put it at the end, the only way to deal with slavery is to lead the people to freedom. The only way to confront the evil of the polis is to build a more just social order with special emphasis on loving the stranger. The contradiction is to be resolved not by philosophical thought, but by redemptive deed. So this is the Great Partnership. To a certain degree, it's what we saw in the opening video. It's telling us that science has its place and we love science, right? But there is a different story to be told, a world about meaning, a world about protest, a world about morality, a world about making this world a better world, about human freedom, human dignity, and all of that. But as I said, what is really, I think, upsetting Rabbi Sacks is something that we maybe saw in the book Morality, in the book where he spoke about the politics of hope, where he's really worried about where our modern secular scientific order is going. And in fact, he talks about how the world we're living in is resting on many of the morals which were sort of created in the incubator of centuries and millennia of religion, and that what we actually need, we're still resting on that basic, you know, goodness and that sort of wellspring of religion. And that if we don't return to a sense of, you know, morality and a sense of thou shalt not, then he really feels that civilization, Western civilization, is endangered. I've given you a fraction of the book. It's a really stunning book. And, you know, as with all of these shiurim, idach zil gemar, you're going to have to go and read the whole book yourself. What can I tell you? Thank you very much for being with us. Next week, we have got our final class. And I would like to, what we're going to be doing, I felt that it was wrong just to look at Rabbi Sacks with so many of his philosophical books. But what I wanted to do here was to talk really about his Torah. And therefore, next week, we're going to look at some excerpts of his on Parashat Shavua. And we're going to start off with actually looking at him on the Sidur. And we're going to look at certain times where he really, really digs into the core of his Jewish thinking. And that's what we're going to look at next week. So Bezrat Hashem will be here same time, same place for our seventh and final shiur. Thank you. Have a great day, everybody, and have a good week.
Thank you.